You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Nick.
You know what's great?
Yeah. No, I don't.
No. What do you think is great?
There's lots that's great in the world. I got a cup of coffee right now. It's like 4 p.m. It's probably like getting too late to have coffee, but I have it. It tastes great. That is great. It's been a nice normal day. It's kind of cold here in Los Angeles, which is nice. I think that's great because it's a little different. I was just on the East Coast where it was like 75 degrees out. And then I come back to LA and it's freezing. We got a fire going, a fake fire, and that's great. Sarah is still here in California with me while you're on the East Coast, so that's great.
Yeah. This is all great. No. I think that what I'm saying is something that a little less like about that, just if you Stephen Colbert put it best, if you get fired from your job and the entire country lights up in celebration and starts dancing in the streets, how shitty must you feel? And I ask that, and I just want to also throw in there, think about this before you answer, and the person who I'm asking this question to knows who they are. A song that is literally titled Fuck Your Name, right? Fuck this person. Has been number one on iTunes since Saturday.
Is there a question?
Fuck Donald Trump.
Oh, that's who you're talking about.
Get the
Little Justin. Little justice, little justice.
Gotcha. Welcome to Little Fucking Justice. Alex Smallow being an asshole.
I've already like evacuated my entire being of that man. Like it doesn't I don't have to think about it anymore.
You don't have to think about it anymore. Isn't that beautiful? Like we don't.
Some people are trying to make it so everyone has to think about it still, but that's no.
Dude,
we're done. We're done with it.
So it's so funny over. Because so at the time of this recording, we're recording this. I guess it's a week and 2 days after the election results came in. Finally, after that long, long wait, and people are still trying to keep him in the news. But the thing is, like, we don't have like I think Chase Buttigieg, Peter Buttigieg's husband said it best. Like, you don't have to retweet him anymore. Like, you don't have to pay any attention to him.
I'm wondering, I read somewhere that actually Twitter only has kept his account, obviously because it's good for their business, I think, but also because they have some clause about public, you know, it's good for the public well-being to be able to hear what the president has to say. But as soon as he's not the president anymore, whatever thing kept his account active no longer applies, and they could easily just cancel him.
Yeah, cancel. Get him out.
Which would be, oh my God. There's so many good things that are going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel bad. You know, me and my wife both, we have an outlook where, like, we don't wish ill on anybody, right? Like, we're kind of humanist in the sense that, like, we don't want bad things to happen. We don't want people to get hurt. This is such a special case where you can feel nice and warm about thinking really bad thoughts about somebody else.
And I'll even go further. You know, I don't want him to get hurt. I just don't want him
not hurt. Well, no, not physically hurt.
No,
not physically hurt. But his ego is so fragile, right?
Yes,
and his
absolutely.
His whole state of being is so propped up on just ego.
Well, and that's
nihilism and all this stuff that, like, it's not going to take much to just completely dismantle this man. And along with it, what he represents.
Sorry to jump in, but like that's so much of what we're seeing right now. Right, again, a week and 2 days out from his loss, he is fighting this, and fighting this in a way. If anybody watches, there's a YouTube channel called Legal Eagle, which I highly suggest you. Anybody who wants to know anything about the law, watches a very good looking host, DJ. Who was a lawyer in DC and like breaks down all sorts of law for you. And he was talking about the kind of this fascinating thing where the stuff, like, you know, publicly, yeah, they're all screaming like count every vote and we're going to sue this and we're going to sue that and we're going to do this. And then what they actually like pay attention to what they're actually filing for in the courts. Cause it's almost like the polar opposite end. Like, it's like the lawyers don't want to perjure themselves because they know that they are going in there with like,
right. Well,
no,
they can't walk in and do something illegal, right? Like, yeah, they'll lose their license. So they have to, they're working just within the bounds to make the boss happy.
Yeah, exactly.
And just enough so that they can then pair it to the public. They, you know, the people who the lawyers are working for can tell the public they're doing all this, this and that and the other thing. But inside the actual courts, like, and we knew this, right? There's no ground to stand on.
No.
Biden's won by such a large margin, and there's absolutely zero evidence of any kind of fraud, which we knew that there wasn't going to be. But everything actually went smoother, I think, than anybody had predicted, right? Well, so smooth that there's really no room for this argument at all.
At all. And it was crazy, right? Because we were all waiting, you know, when I remember, so, you know, Tuesday night happens, and we'd been told there was going to be a red mirage or a blue mirage for weeks and weeks and weeks. And still, you know, when Tuesday night ends and, like, you see that Trump is looking like he's ahead in several states, you know, when I went to teach my class on Wednesday morning, I will say, like, I was fucking depressed.
Oh, we turned it off after a while. Oh, I just went to bed and like, okay, yep, here we go, is another 4 years of this. Like, I can't believe that happened again, but I kind of can believe that happened again, and was hoping it wouldn't, but it did. And then 3 agonizing days later,
you start
to realize that, oh,
oh my God. And it was
so many people voted by mail.
Dude, so many people, because that was great, because it was like, yes, thank God the nation is being fucking smart and not trying to go outside in the goddamn pandemic.
And the Trump campaign knew that was going to happen, right? But their whole plan of attack was get the most votes on voting night, on election night, and then when they start to lose, say, oh, like, you can't do that, like, we won, like, claim victory early,
yeah,
and then start talking about how it's all fraudulent. But, like, it happened in such a decisive manner that
it's insane. You can't, there's literally nothing you can say. And
yeah,
and again, with the Florida recount, was like, it was literally a margin of 500 votes. Y'all, Pennsylvania is upwards of 50,000 votes. There's no way.
Georgia's doing a by hand recount right now, just to satisfy everybody, just to show you how not wrong it is.
It's so funny.
And maybe it'll be off by a couple votes, but you know, there's like 15 or 20,000 vote margin in there. Like, it's over.
It's
so over, and it makes me so happy. So he's kicking and screaming, and he's not helping the transition team. He refuses to acknowledge that Biden won, and so there's no transition team being put in place. Like, refusing, you know, the briefings, the daily briefings that the incoming president's supposed to get, and the office space and the staff and all that stuff. But, like, Biden's like, I'm fine. I don't care. Like, he can do this.
Well, and that's the thing. That's the thing that I was thinking too, was like, even, you know, everyone's screaming and crying, you know, not screaming, but like, everyone's worried about the fact that, like, you know, the confidential documents that Biden should be able to see at this point, he's not going to be able to see. But the thing that, like, gives me solace is remembering that, like, yes, is like, are they updating Biden on current threats? No, right? They're not. But Biden was the vice president. So, like, he, you know, I mean, like, I'm not saying that people are, you know, unsealing documents that shouldn't be unsealed, but I'm also like, I highly doubt.
Part of the transition is about getting in and understanding the functioning, right? So you're not plopped down on January 21st being like, oh God, like, where's everybody's office supposed to be? Like, how does this work day to day? Like, he knows the functioning. He knows how it is, because he's been there.
And
if he can remember, I don't know what his brain's doing at this point. Maybe he doesn't remember being vice president.
You know, it might as well be melted cheese. It might as well be Kamala Harris, you know, puppeteering it from afar. I literally don't care. I'm just so happy he won.
I don't care.
Like, you know what? You know, can I say this honestly? Because I know so many people were like, I didn't vote for Joe Biden. I voted against Donald Trump. And that's fair. And I get that. I will say this. Couple nights ago, had a binge watch of, like, all of the Obama White House videos with Biden. And there are several. I mean, he just shares a charm with Obama that I think is wonderful. And, like, there's so many of their little, like, they used to do, like, these little mini videos of their little bromance that were, like, these, like, little short films that were, like, truly hysterical. Like, there's some of them that I just sat there watching. I was like, y'all are fucking dumb. But then I will say, the one that got me, if you want to know who Biden is as a man, and I don't know him personally, but I'm just like, there's no way you fake this. Watch when Obama surprised him with the what's the award? It's the Medal of Honor.
Yeah, that medal, whatever it is. I know the picture.
It's truly, when you, I mean, watching that video is one of the most moving videos I've ever seen of any sort of government, president, anything. And you just see these two men who have such respect for each other. And it's so amazing, especially now, like when we've had a president who can't even spell the word humble, to see Joe Biden like lost for words, like so floored.
Yeah.
The first thing he does is be like, I would not be anywhere without my sons, without my wife. Do you mean like I'm nobody? Like, and like, it's, well,
I
just
think humility is a big part of it. Because like, you know, I don't know enough about Joe Biden's voting record. I don't know enough even about his political career general.
It's a little spotty.
It doesn't take much to see just that he is, you know, as much as he's a politician, as much as he does the whole like charm, kiss babies thing that politicians do, he's a genuine person, right? His yep. morals are in the right place and his humility is right. And the way that the perspective he has is correct, right? The perspective of it's all of us together, like America, instead of looking at America as a series of problems and trying to like crush certain problems, it's looking at America as a series of potentials.
Yeah.
Right. It's looking at America as we could be better and together, like we can be better. And there's where people split is on how to get there. Right.
Exactly. But
I think having someone who is not, you know, focused on himself and focused on getting the anger out of people and just getting back to decency is just such a huge emotional shift.
I really think that it's going to be an amazing tonal shift for this country and we're just all going to feel much better. And this is to say nothing of Kamala, who like broke every freaking barrier in the book.
I love the one image that's like the list of all the vice presidents in emojis, and it's all just the old white man emoji. And then at the bottom, Kamala, just the black woman emoji. And it's like, yeah,
brilliant. And I'm so happy for her. I'm so happy for everyone who looks like her. I'm so happy for, you know, it's just such a win. And I love that she's a freaking stepmom, right? She's not like, this is not, you know, this is also the first, I think one of the first vice presidents who's coming in there without their own kids. Like the kids who call her mom are not her kids. Do you know what I mean?
Really? So the second husband, right? The first second husband.
Yeah.
Is also, I didn't know she was a stepmom. He had a kid before they got married.
Those two kids are his kids.
Really?
At least that's my understanding. And someone correct me if I'm wrong, but that's my understanding. And that's great. Like
that's amazing.
Just, it's just a different represent. You know, I mean, like let's get some different people in there and like,
right.
You know, and I look, and again, I'm just looking at the heroes of the thing. Freaking Buttigieg is, you know, on Fox News every day, slashing and dashing.
He's been putting himself in the right places.
Yeah. Oh no, he definitely wants to be speaking.
And Fox News itself, which dismantled that fucking propaganda machine.
Yes.
But I will say in the last few weeks, as the rats have been fleeing the ship, they've been fleeing with them. Like they really have, you know.
No, they've done it.
Which
I think, you know, which is in strong, comparison or juxtaposition, I should say, to what they did in 2016. Because that's the thing that I think at some point we have to reconcile with. And it's not now. It's truly not right now. But once we get through these next 2 months, I really want us to go back as a nation and be like, hey, news media, and not just Fox News, MSNBC,
all of it,
CNN,
no, all of it. Yeah.
You guys handed Trump the election in 2016 and you did your job this time, but like you guys really fucked up last time. And what can we do to continue to create a less partisan news? I mean, and I know, you know, we repealed the law that would have prevented this, you know what I mean? So like
that's what we need is regulation, because it's not just the news, right?
No.
The news is how your grandmother gets this, but your dad and your uncle and everybody, they get it from Facebook.
Yeah.
Right? They're getting it from these algorithmically driven sets of things that are meant to just keep you clicking, right? These crazy articles and crazy stories, and everybody, you know, in these echo chambers, they create these weird echo chambers online driven by AI, right? It's not even anybody sitting there like, yes, now show them the conservative media and they will fall for our plan. It's like, no, what the monster that Facebook is, the computer,
yep,
has figured out person by person is that people can get sucked into these, you know, weird QAnon vortexes.
Yes.
And there's no regulation in place to make sure that that stuff, like there's no regulation on that information. It could be anything.
Yeah.
Short of like an image that says like kill the president. Like it could literally be any kind of information that it wants to be. And if a lot of people start clicking on it, it will deliver it to more people because that's what it's built to do is make money. And like, that's scary.
It's terrifying.
That's scary.
Terrifying. And I think that, we really need to look at these systems. And I mean, you know, I'll put out some, just, you know, in case anybody's listening who wants to, you know, get more facts with their news. You know, I would say, the only things that I paid attention to during the election were NPR. And Associated Press, BBC is great. Do you mean BBC just by virtue of them being outside of our country? They have a really unbiased view. And then also, I will say, Jessica Yellen on Instagram. Jessica Yellen is a former CNN correspondent who now has her own channel and brand and new and hashtag News Not Noise. But like, it's just a great place to just get facts. Yes.
I mean, I think too, there needs to be a certain level of personal responsibility because it's easy to sit there and let people tell you what to think and how to feel. If you can just break down, if you can look at whatever, you know, CNN's on 24 hours a day. Of course, they have to build in some kind of thing to keep people drawn in for 24 hours a day that goes beyond, you know, this person said this event happened. But if people can start to pare away the opinion and pare away the buzzwords and start seeing how it's being delivered to them and just look at what's happening for what's happening, right? If you just look at Trump for what he says and what he does and don't listen to opinion about the other side, don't listen, like if you just take him at his word, in on camera, on microphone, listen to his words and look at the actual actions he takes. And there's no way that you can support somebody like that. But if it's supported by a lot of people saying he's great, he's doing it right, he's doing this, then suddenly what he says is not what he says. It's what Fox News says.
And you have to do a deep dive of what he says too, because it's not just, it's, I think one of the things that, you know, people are able to spit facts about what he's done, right? So I've had several talks with a lot
of Trump's. you get exposed to some people online, don't you? I can see you digging into some conversations.
Oh, I love it. Well, and that's my thing, is because I love having these conversations, because eventually there will come a point, and I'm not, this is not a judgment, you know, this is not even about conservative. I'm not even saying this is a conservative. Here's what I will say. Every conservative that I've had a conversation with, at some point we agree on facts. At some point I present a fact and they say, yeah, you know what? That's a fact. Or they present the fact and I'm like, yeah, there's nothing I can say to that. That is actually factual. Right. Like that's where we need to get back to.
That's where we need to be.
Where you know, the hardcore Trump supporters, what ends up happening is a lot of deflection. Like, so one of the things that in conversations that I've had with Trump supporters, they love to throw in is that the African-American community is not aware of the number of things Trump has done for them because of mainstream.
Yeah, he passed through a major prison reform bill, didn't he?
He passed through that's one of the things they throw in is the First Step Act. Now, what the First Step Act is absolutely a prison reform bill. It has gotten about 300,000 people out of prison earlier than they would have been if my numbers are correct. What basically it is putting in place programs and transition resources so that these prisoners can, you know, whether it's, you know, work that they do while incarcerated, classes they take, can do these kinds of things, and depending on what crime they committed, cut down on their sentence time so that they can get out earlier and be you know, kind of factory lined into a job on the outside. So on the surface, First Step Act is great, right? It absolutely does something for our incarcerated population. Here's the things that it does not take care of. The First Step Act does not account for the fact that the prisons are still underfunded and understaffed. Mm-hmm. So all the classes that you are expecting these people to take to do this, there's no one to teach them, and there's no funding to create them. And on top of that, you're still not, yes, you're getting people out faster, but the structures that are putting them in unfairly are still in place.
And that's the real kind of core issue, isn't it?
And so it's a half measure, and what I keep saying, you know, to me it breaks down like this. There has to be some empathy at some point. Even, you know, I had a conversation, this is a whole conversation that I had with a major Trump supporter, and his whole thing was about individual sovereignty and the idea that your needs and whatever you want to do, your freedom of choice comes before any responsibility that you have to the community. And that is a way of thinking. That's absolutely a way of thinking. It's a way of thinking that justified putting tens of millions of us in bondage because you dehumanize us to think of us as three-fifths of a person, as a labor force or as a labor tool and not a human being. So like,
right.
It's that, it's just, it's, it comes back to very basic principles. And I'm not saying that the liberal, you know, side of things is not flawed. It absolutely is. But we have to just look at the facts of things, like you said. And if you look factually at the things that Trump has done, they're all aesthetic and they're all geared towards the numbers and like success to make it look like this is something that's bigger than it actually is. Because the First Step Act is bullshit, truly bullshit, you know.
That's interesting. I understand the perspective of, right, and people look at America, right, the formation of America as this like the ability for people to have their own destiny, to control their own destiny, right? And it puts it a lot on an individual's shoulders. Like, if you can't make enough money, that's your fault. Get a better job. If you can't, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, like, everybody is responsible for their own problems, and taking care of yourself is the most important thing. Like, I can see where somebody would come from. What boggles my mind about where American conservatism has gone is that they are actively voting for policies that work against those values.
Yes.
But then still preaching them.
To me, what's fascinating about the why behind that, why you are voting against your own interests or your own policies or your own political beliefs, it comes down to this entire thing where you are now, especially in the post-Trump era, like, it's the reason that all this stuff is happening, because they're trying. I'm not a political analyst, but I'm just looking at the facts and seeing what you're doing. You know that even though these people are fucked up, they're your base now. These people are your base, so you can't piss off your base. And I think that I don't think that everybody who voted for Trump is, you know, do I think that they are outwardly racist? No, I don't think that everybody who voted for him is outwardly racist. I think that they are contributing to a racist campaign, whether knowingly or unknowingly. And I think that's the problem, is that blind eye ignorance. And that's why, you know, as much as people shit on the Lincoln Project, I'm like, no, we need more things like the Lincoln Project, which are like being like, hey, we as a party used to have standards. And we need to bring those back, and we can disagree with people on the way. Joe Biden, and this is the last I'll say on it, but Joe Biden had said it perfectly in his town hall. It used to, the thing was, you may have in the kind of glory days of politics, which, you know, still many people were not experiencing that glory, but at least in terms of the glory days of how things were run between politicians, he said you never questioned anybody's motives. You always knew that the person that you were arguing against wanted the best for your country. It was never about where they were coming from. It was just about the way that they were going about getting there didn't sit with you. But now we are in a place where, like, people are questioning motives. And in the case of Trump, with good reason, because you can't just looking at what he's done, you can't tell me this man is about America. Trump is about Trump.
Trump is about Trump.
You know, that's who he is. So you can't use a person like that as a tool to get what you want in America, because he's not a tool. He's a bull in a china shop. He's narcissism embodied. So yeah, it's a whole discussion. But, you know, I would say that, you know, with Trump, and I promise the last thing I'll say on it, I think if you look at Trump and view him as anything more or anything less than, dare I say, a political farce.
See, I was going to say that there is no punny transition, because this whole thing just literally is a farce. it's all just a political farce in and of itself. Like, there's no clever
No, there's no clever way here. To get in there. I was trying to, for those of you listening, I was trying to do and pull an Alex Smalow and transition into what, you know, what well, this podcast is actually
this,
about.
This was, that was softball for your first try. So
I really
good,
did.
Good
it was
job.
Like a soft little landing there because today's topic is, of course, the political farce.
Oh, yeah. I keep having every episode we have to remind ourselves that we're a movie podcast.
There's just so many. There's so much else happening in the
oh,
world.
Oh, my God. Like being on with Brandon a couple weeks ago, we didn't even talk about movies until the second part episode.
Oh, not at all. And part of that's just Brandon, because Brandon is just like a deep ass dude, and he'll just like, yeah, you know, he just goes on, he goes off on these beautiful tangents, so do we. You know, there is so much happening in the world. Per case in point, and I promise is not a humble brag, so I'm you know, I'm doing things for Ain't Too Proud right now, and I had this moment today where I realized my costumes that like still fit. And like, this is, you know, this is 9 months out from the last time I did the show on Broadway. And these costumes were costumes that had to be taken in, for, you know, several times during the course of my rehearsal, because I was just dropping weight because it's just such a physically hard show. And I was like, oh my God, these costumes still fit. And then I realized, oh wait, that's the amount of stress on my body that is burning calories that fast, because this world is so fucked.
So you've just been sitting inside for 9 months, just sweating anxiety,
just stressing,
just keeping
and
all
being
that
anxious,
all that weight off. I've gone the other way. The other way. But I haven't gotten. I've probably put on maybe 10 pounds during this whole thing.
You're
right?
Beautiful.
Oh, and I got a little tum-tum now.
It's fine.
It's fine because, you know, of course I'm allowed to do that.
Yeah.
But we just ordered it's called a Tonal.
What is that?
It's like a Peloton for weights. It's like this thing that you mount on your wall.
Oh,
they
shit.
Come and mount it on your wall, and it's got two arms that come off it with you know, bands that come out, and it's got a bar you can attach to it and stuff, and it kind of smart controls the weight, and you run through on a screen. There's like instructors and stuff that run you through exercises and build programs that tracks all the different, you know, reps and all that. Because of COVID, it's like we ordered it like 12 weeks ago. We still haven't got it yet. So,
well, it will come.
Fingers crossed. I'm gonna drop this tummy.
You get drop the tummy, but not because you don't look beautiful, just because you want to for yourself.
Yeah, because I want to. I want to feel better.
That's right.
Still eat pizza. I don't care.
Oh, dude, I'm totally getting fucking Chinese food tonight. Now, granted, it's gonna be probably vegan Chinese food, but it's still gonna be delicious.
Ah, it's disgusting.
No, it's not disgusting. If you get it from Jujube Tree, I'm shouting out Jujube Tree right now. In Queens, Jujube Tree is delicioso.
We are neither sponsored by Tonal nor Jujube Tree.
No, we are not. But you know, we are sponsored by sponsors. So how about this, guys? We will take a break, and when we come back, we will discuss the movies of the political farce, the political farce movies. So stay tuned.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So yeah, today we're talking about the political farce movie. Now, Alex, this was your choice. So what made you? Was it just the farce?
What do you
Trump?
Mean? What made me? Yeah. I was like, what is the post-election episode going to be? Because we took a week off, get our bearings.
Yeah. Did you miss us? I hope you did.
My Apple Watch. Oh, it's my birthday tomorrow, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I got an Apple Watch, but it makes noises.
Aww.
So that's annoying. Okay. Silent mode. What else was this going to be? I gave you the option. We can do political thriller or we can do political farce.
Yeah.
And I think the answer to that question is pretty clear because I love political thriller movies.
I love them too. And there's several of them. So I was actually going to break my thing with political thriller when you suggested it. I was like, ooh, if we do that one, we actually should maybe get more specific because there's like,
yeah, there's a lot. There's, and we can, you know, yeah. if people want to hear it, we can get deeply involved
absolutely.
I think the thing I love about political movies in general when they're done well, whether they're comedies or thrillers or whatever, is that and it's what changes in a post-Trump era now, which is I'm excited to see what comes out of films like this moving forward, because there's an inherent intelligence to them.
Yes,
right? There's an inherent shrouded the mystery that shrouds the inner workings of the federal government.
Yep.
The people who work up there are supposed to be, at least, very intelligent, very careerist, very, you know, quick speaking, you know, lawyers and all, you know, politicians and all these people who are constantly juggling what's best versus what's best for them versus what's best for what their goal they're trying to achieve versus all these things. And the stakes are America. And that always adds up to really exciting stuff, even in comedic situations. Like just to see behind the scenes, the conversations that happen in the Oval Office is inherent drama.
Yeah.
And that's what changes now is like, there's been a clown stampeding through these hallways for 4 years, completely exposing how unorganized it all is, right? Completely exposing how open to, you know, bad actors' whimsies.
Yes,
it is. And so the movie I chose especially kind of highlighted that. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I agree, and I think that's kind of, you know, I'm to me, we'll see if this holds up, because there's really only two people who do this. Like so many people have done political farce. I think there's two people who have done this better than anyone else, and I think, and so I'm wondering if our movies are going to be coming from one of these two creators. Mine certainly does, because I think that's kind of what I always love about political farce is inevitably you see, you know, it's a peek behind the curtain and you see how freaking idiotic these people are, and the fun of it is like, these are the people who are running our country? And
exactly.
The answer is like, yes.
Yeah.
Like 100%.
Because you just assume if you're in that position, you must have earned it. You must be a better person. You must be smarter. You must be harder working. You must be wealthier. You must be like, they must exist on another plane. You know, people who are not enticed by human desires and fallibilities. But it absolutely is the case. Almost probably except for the Secret Service agents who are trained to not be susceptible to whimsy. I think everybody else is.
Oh my God.
It's terrifying.
It's really terrifying. Actually. And it makes you, and that's why I actually love, you know, I love when they can, when whatever the movie is, if they can find a way, like whether it's actually a real event that they're depicting or can ground it in a reality. I love that, because I think a political farce works best when it just makes you that much more aware, even like not even consciously, but just on the back of your, in the back of your throat, you're just that much more aware of how important it is who you choose to put in power.
Yeah.
You know, that is the win of the farce to me, because then, you know, it's not only made you laugh, but it's done its job. It's taught you something. Like you're really thinking now. And I love that. I love
now. How much is a political farce? Is it inherent that you're going to be talking about the executive cabinet, the president and his staff?
No,
I don't need to.
I think it can be seen from all sides, right? I think what goes into the body politic, what are the components? That's not just the cabinet. That's the reporters. That's, do you know what I mean? Like, I think, you know, in a way, you know, like, you know, I truly am not saying this is a political farce, right? I'm not saying this political farce at all, but the producers, Mel Brooks producers, you know, has elements, has strong elements of a political fart, like that. Just the idea. It's just like anytime you pull back the curtain.
I was going to say that exact phrase. Anytime you pull back the curtain.
And I think that now here's what I will say. I think that what does have to be in place, I think that it really does work better for people in power. Like, I'm not interested in people who are the have-nots. I'm not interested in seeing the Occupy Wall Street political farce because
there's no stakes, right? There's an implied, the people at the top, the people who are running the country, and that's what's been highlighted by the last 4 years, like everything that they do echoes out to every single person in the country in one way or another, right? Yeah. These decisions have an effect on every single person. There's nothing else in the country or the world that has an effect like that.
Yeah.
And so even if it's funny, even if you're laughing along with it, you care because you know the next decision that this character makes could affect every single person in the country.
Yep.
Yeah. That's heavy. That's heavy. So what makes a farce then? Is there a difference between comedy and farce, or is a political comedy going to inherently be a farce just because watching people like that flounder is inherently farcical?
Well, so I just looked up the definition of farce. Farce is defined as a comic dramatic work using buffoonery and horseplay, and typically including crude characterization and ludicrously improbable situations.
Right.
And so I think, right, comedy is not that. Like, comedy is something a little different. Comedy is a little more broad than that, right? Mm-hmm. This is very much talking about, like, the ridiculosity of all this. That is a farce. It's like, it is so ridiculous. And I think that a political farce, I think the reason that it's just, you know, what makes it special is it's like, it's ridiculous, but if you really think about it, could probably and probably is happening right now.
Because my choice, I wasn't sure. I was like, it borderlines farce. And then I looked up the same definition of farce, and ludicrously improbable situations is what caught me, because this is what we were talking about before, right? Is we will never know.
Yeah.
Besides taking the tour of the White House, we will never get close enough to the inner workings of how this works to know what is and isn't possible. So an improbable situation could actually be a very probable situation, but just given the elevation of it, is going to seem improbable. It's going to seem absurd.
It's going to seem absurd. Well, and this is why, to me, there was really only one choice. And I say that, like, knowing that there have been several movies that have done this, but movies that have, like, been a political farce that have truly hit me in the gut and been like, that is not only a great political farce, but also possibly a perfect movie. There's only been one. And so I was like, I'm very interested to see what your thought is, because I don't know. I'm interested to see. Yeah. I want to know what you're
interesting.
There's
one that's very, very obvious for political farce. Obvious. There's one that's super obvious, which I didn't pick.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Because I figured we'd talk about it anyway. Was it made by a very prominent director? Is that what you're talking about?
Was it made in the 1960s?
Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Strangelove.
Okay. I didn't pick it.
I didn't pick it either.
Okay. So let's just talk about Dr. Strangelove first, just to get it out of the way, because that's the obvious one, right?
Yeah.
And for some reason is the only really standing true example of it.
No. See, that's the thing, dude. Okay,
that's what it feels like.
Maybe it's just my perspective, but there was a movie. So Dr. Strangelove, directed by Stanley Kubrick, starring the great Peter Sellers, starring who else is in that? George C. Scott. A lot of old dead dudes. About a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union and just all the insanity that comes from that, right? Just all the machinations behind the decision making, everything. Peter Sellers in dual roles, right? It's how many roles does he play in that film? He plays three.
He's what the
he's Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah,
and then he's president.
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
He's the president of the United States, and he's one more that I'm forgetting. But brilliant comic performance, everything, nothing really, I wouldn't say anything's played for laughs.
He's the captain, the British officer.
Yep, yep. I wouldn't say anything's played for laughs in this movie. It's just...
Well, no, it's given because you're watching people, not just the president and what that infers, but you're watching the people with their fingers on the button too, yes. Right? It's a whole movie about the implication of power and how the absurdity of humanity is completely in contrast to the responsibility of nuclear power.
Yes.
And so it's everything that we've been talking about is like, hey, like, the whole, like, our whole society is inherently ridiculous.
Inherently
ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, Dimitri, you know exactly where they're going, and I'm sure your entire air defense can stop a single plane. Listen, I mean, it's not going to help either one of us if the doomsday machine goes off now, is it? Dimitri, there's no point in you getting hysterical at a moment like this.
So Dr. Strangelove, the classic example.
And set the tone for everything that came after.
Yes.
You know,
there's actually, did you see, it was a play and they did a televised one take version of it that I watched in high school about hitting the nuclear button.
Oh, about no, the I've opportunity. And, I'd love to see that.
I can't remember. It's got an amazing cast. It was filmed in one take. And aired on TV, and I completely forget the name. So somebody tell you.
Yeah, hit us up if you hit us up on the Twitter.
Hit us up if you know
at Lil Justice Pod, or on the Instagram at.
But it's good because it's basically Dr. Strangelove, but it strips out the absurdity. It just takes it very seriously.
Is it funny? No, it takes it seriously.
No, it's not. It's not at all. It's like something code or code red or Red Alert, or it's got some kind of name like that, but it's the same situation, kind of like there's an impending attack coming, and do we strike back? Do we strike first? Do we, you know, and all the implications and stuff that come with that, and the drama of just do you or don't you press the button? Who knows what the answer is? But do you want to take us through?
No, you go first because I actually really want to hear what you chose.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because
I will say, yeah. I really enjoyed watching this movie.
Okay.
I remember liking it when I was younger, didn't remember much about it. And I just enjoyed putting on my headphones and it felt warm and nice to watch a movie like this. And it connected a lot with what's going on now. So we open on Washington, D.C., the White House, the Capitol, the Monument, a helicopter, the presidential air. Is it Air Force One? No. What do you call the helicopter?
Yeah. It's a. Oh my God. I think it's not Air Force One.
It's not Air Force One.
Hang on. I'm going to look that up.
Helicopter One.
Hang on.
Something.
Air
Force Two.
Let me see. No, it's
Whirly
not,
Bird.
It's not.
Whirly Bird One.
Marine One. Marine One. That's what it is.
Marine One. That's what it is that took Trump to the hospital. Marine One. Flies, lands on the White House lawn. The president steps out with his wife. You know, nice, clean cut, hair slicked back, waves to the reporters. Two corgis come running out. They've got, you know, these two dogs hand in hand. The president and the first lady and their two dogs walk to the White House. You know, oh, thank you for coming. You know, yada, yada, yada. Good to see you. They walk in as soon as the doors are shut behind them. The leashes drop and the aides scramble to collect the dogs. They crisscross the wife and the president and they go off in opposite directions immediately. They hate each other, you can tell. They want nothing to do with each other. And they're off and running.
Mm-hmm. Is it... I ask, is the president played by one Kevin Kline?
It's very possible that the president is played by Kevin Kline.
That's amazing. That's what a great movie.
And the movie is?
Dave.
I'm Dwayne Stevenson with the United States Secret Service. We're with the federal government.
Oh, look, I swear I thought that was a legitimate deduction. See, I do impersonation, so I use that television with
Mr.
my work.
Mr. Kovic, we're not here about your taxes. On occasion, for security purposes, the Secret Service hires someone to double for the president at public functions and exposed situations. Your government needs your help.
Dave.
Directed by Ivan Reitman, correct?
It is.
Yeah.
Directed by Ivan Reitman. Yeah. And Jason Reitman played, I saw at the very end of this movie, the vice president played by Ben Kingsley is getting sworn in, and his like son, quote unquote, is standing next to him. And I thought that guy kind of looks familiar. Jason Reitman.
I love it. I love it. It's also, Dave was, I don't know where it stands now, but was on track to be made into a musical. Actually,
was it?
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Dave is one of those weird movies because it came out about the same time as The American President, right? Which is a similar look behind the curtain, as you will, at the presidency, and a hard decision on a personal nature that a president needs to make, and the situation seemingly absurd.
Yep.
Actual, the movie, the script is so good. The script takes such care to make sure it never quite gets into the absurd that you buy it emotionally. You're like, okay. And it's not till you step back after you get to the end and you're like, wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense at all. If anything works how it's supposed to, if our government is formed in any way that it's supposed to, this entire plot should be completely impossible. So for those who don't know, Dave is a movie about an asshole president, right?
Asshole.
So maybe you could start drawing parallels. If not, okay. There's a president. He is a dick. He hates his wife and she hates him back. He has broken the law and is covering it up with his chief of staff, who is also a giant dick. And they've created this environment. He is in what, I don't know if this happened before or after. he was, I think it was before the Bill Clinton scandal, but he's having an affair with his secretary who works right outside the Oval Office. And he ends up having a heart attack, a stroke during, he's like sleeping with this secretary.
Mr. President?
So they go and they find an impersonator, right, to fill the role. But it's not like his administration says, we need to find an impersonator. It's literally just his chief of staff and his chief of staff's crony. Two people quietly decide, we're going to replace the president with this lookalike. They take no precautions, right? The president has a stroke. There's doctors and EMT, and they go to the hospital, all this. They somehow convince the public that the stroke was minor, and they find an impersonator and teach him how to be president in like an hour. And then they stick him in front of the world and he takes over. Now, over the course of this, like Dave is the impersonator. You know, he runs a temporary employment agency, a temp agency. You could tell from the beginning he's a good guy helping people find work. He really cares. He rides his bike home singing. And it's just a fun-loving, energetic guy, contrasted to the president being, you know, a drab, negative Nancy.
God bless you! God bless America!
So he ends up taking it and running with it. And over the course of that, falls in love with the president's wife, who falls in love with him back. And there's this whole song and dance. And so the movie revolves around this premise about, can you just swap out the president with somebody who has no experience, no training, no idea who anybody is or how anything works. Like literally all they give him is they've made like a chart on a whiteboard that shows, you know, oh, well, these people report to these people who report to you. And then he knows how to be president. An absurd, absurd situation. But the script emotionally makes it work. Somehow.
And what's the lesson of it is that even if you don't have the day-to-day knowledge of what the presidency is, if you're a good person, you can make it work.
That's the absurd part to me though. And yeah, that's what the last 4 years have kind of enlightened me to is like it's very, very important. It maybe is the most important thing to be a good person and have a moral compass.
Yes.
But there is so much more complexity to the presidency than just a can-do attitude.
No, right? And he, I mean, he does get replaced at the, it's not like he stayed, right? Because
well, he gets, yeah. Well, so they solve it by having him, fake a stroke.
Yeah.
Right. And then they just slip the real president back in a ridiculous at the end. Right. He gives a big speech because he ends up firing the chief of staff who brought him on, who's evil, Frank Langella, who yep. is an incredible actor who I saw incredible. At a Bristol Farms a couple of months ago.
Aww.
Very old now, just at the salad bar, just scoop. It was before COVID. He was just scooping some food in and humming to himself. I'm like, Frank Langella. Awesome.
Love you, Frank Langella.
But very, very old. So he fires him, right? Because he's the president now, even though he's not the president, nobody knows. So then Frank Langella outs the president for being involved in this illegal thing. And so he goes before the whole world and says, yes, I was involved in this. And the vice president's a good man. And so whatever. And then he has a heart attack, fakes it. They rush him to the hospital. They have the real president in the ambulance waiting. They rush the real president into the hospital while Kevin Klein is sitting in a baseball cap in the front of the ambulance.
Yep.
They don't drive around the corner and let him get out. This guy who looks exactly like the president, he has a nice little conversation with Ving Rhames with hair, says, thanks for everything, Secret Service Ving Rhames with hair, and then just gets out at the hospital. At the hospital where the president is supposed to have just been rushed in with a stroke, where the media is swarming, all this stuff, just hops out of the ambulance that just brought the president here and walks away. Like, they really just shuffle off any sort of notion of reality.
Yeah.
And it feels good. It just feels good. James Newton Howard did the score, and it carries your heart.
Yeah, and you know, again, I have not seen this movie in a long, long time, so forgive me, but I just do remember that sense of, like, you know, it's Mr. Smith goes to Washington, just like any time, it's, you know, the idea of, like, if you put a good soul in the corruption and insanity of the Washington D.C. scene, will they come out clean? And he does. Like, he ends up coming out with, like, a,
he does,
you
but,
know,
but again, it's what makes it farce to me, because maybe 4 years ago I wouldn't have thought that it was farce. At a certain point, it's either not taken seriously enough or taken too seriously, like the weight of the office, right? It's like, it's a 4 year post, and this guy's already a couple years into it.
Yep.
And so they take his, he makes a transformation and passes this big job reform bill to save a homeless shelter, all this stuff. And the movie celebrates it like he has just changed the world forever. But we know that how it works is, as soon as you pass one thing through, someone else is going to be in your way and they're going to change it. It's always a work in progress, and there's never a conquered moment, right? There's never a moment where you have slain the dragon of healthcare or unemployment or whatever, because it's always going to be this back and forth. And so to have a movie that uses Hollywood trope to handle it in that manner, big triumphant moments where everybody's cheering and he's succeeded, and, you know, just really melodramatic, it seems absurd to me. No, right now.
Well, and this is interesting because, right, this is not even the movie's intention, right? The movie is trying to sell you on the feel good aspect of, he won and he did it,
and it does it. Like, if you put your brain away, the movie's great.
The movie does it.
Performances and the script and the music and everything's great.
You know, but I think this actually, it's a great point, because it points to something that I've always thought needs to change in the national conversation, which is the fact that the two, at its best, if we were to have a two-party system that was devoid of money and corruption and ridiculousness, at its best, what it would serve as is a checks and balance system.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Where, like, yes,
it would be boring, like it should be.
It should absolutely be boring. It should be fiscal responsibility balanced with the needs of the people. That's what it should be, right? And I think that, you know, when it becomes something more and deeper than that is where we are now, and it's political theater. And that's what I think that, you know, the human element will always bring the theater, right? This really should not be. And again, we're also a young country, so we have not had the, you know, multiple centuries of experience needed in some cases to finally get to boring politics, as a country, as a world we have. But, you know, it, I think that the sooner we can get there, the more, the better it will be. Did you, talk to me about Kevin Kline, because he's truly one of my favorite actors.
So Kevin Kline, so temporarily a dual role, and I feel like he's played other dual roles, hasn't he? It was Michael Keaton in Multiplicity, but Wild Wild West. Where he plays two versions of the same thing. Kevin Kline's amazing.
Oh, we're lookalikes. We don't look like each other, but I mean, I know what you're thinking. People hire us to impersonate the president and the first lady. We work out of an agency. That's where we met.
They sure look like them.
Thanks. Well, we work very hard at it. I mean, she got her hair cut to look. It's a perfect match. We just played the Saperstein wedding. They loved us. We did our Club Med routine where the first lady and the president, they go down to Club Med. And there's Bill Mitchell, you know, he's like,
at 0700, I want an hour of volleyball. And then at 0830, I want a complete briefing on the whole surf situation.
I never really knew much about him until I edited the Galaxy Quest documentary that came out last year. I was an editor on that, and there's a section where they talked about how Kevin Kline was supposed to play the protagonist, and the way that they're talking about him as this king of kind of physical slapstick and timing and all this stuff, like starting to go back through his previous roles and what he's done, he really is sharp.
No,
you know, I always kind of looked at him as like an American Hugh Grant, like kind of sophisticated, or Colin Firth. I always got him and Colin Firth mixed up, but then you look at, he's really not that.
No, he's not.
He's very funny, because he's relatable, right? He looks like a boring kind of buttoned up, you know, like he'd be your accountant or something like that. And he's just kind of like a few cents short of a dollar.
Dude.
You know, there's just a certain ignorance to the world that plays into these in these big situations.
See, I don't know how far back you went, but you need to go back to his Broadway days. Because he was like sexy leading man.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I could see it for sure. Because he also is. He's dashingly.
Yeah, he's very dashing. And like, and he's just one of those actors who you just watch him. You watch his stuff on stage, you watch him in film, and he's just so free and so...
Yeah.
Oh, like almost...
Well, so...
Go ahead.
So this actually contributes to the biggest plot hole in Dave.
Okay.
Which comes at the very end when Dave decides to run for local office.
Yep.
So he has just paraded in front of the world as the president, right? And they because of his personality, the whole movie, they're like, oh my God, the president like had a little stroke and had his brush with death, and now he's seeing the world in a new way. They're watching him be himself as president for a while. He doesn't change how he looks to be the president. They don't give him a new haircut. They don't change his face. They don't do anything. It's just him. And now he's out running for office as this, where if anybody just lined up two video clips next to each other of the guy running for office and the president giving a speech, it would be impossible not to know that it's the same exact person. Like,
absolutely. But that's,
it doesn't make any sense.
No,
it doesn't make any sense.
It's an absurd landscape. That this movie takes place in, but again, yes. Sold by wonderful performances from wonderful actors and a great script. Dave.
Yeah, Dave. Watch it again. It's very good. Sigourney Weaver. Laura Linney is the secretary who the president has the affair with. She a small but Laura Linney role. Frank Langella, again, Ving Rhames with hair. And this was the year before Pulp Fiction.
Oh.
This was right before Pulp Fiction. So he's like about to just break out
in his prime. In his prime.
Oh man, it's wonderful.
Yeah, dude,
it's wonderful.
I forgot that I was hired to do a job for you, and that was just a temp job at that. I forgot that I had 250 million people who were paying me to make their lives a little bit better, and I didn't live up to my part of the bargain. I ought to care more about you than I do about me. I ought to care about more about. I ought to care more about what's right than I do about what's popular. I ought to be willing to give up this whole thing for something I believe in.
Now, see, this is interesting because I actually went a very different route. I went a very different route. And this is I'll be very interested to see what you think of my pick. And if you haven't seen my pick, I'm going to be truly upset with you.
I still have trouble with last week's pick. When we did slasher movies, I thought more and more about it. Man, The Faculty, not a slasher movie.
I know. I squeaked not a by slasher on that movie. One. I squeaked by. But this one is absolutely 100% a political farce through and through. And in my opinion, I dare say, the best political farce in the past 30 years to me. We usually talk about favorites on this. Bold claim, yep. The best. So we open with classical music. We open in a specific country at a specific time, but I can't tell you the country at the time because I think that will give it away. Okay. But just know that we open at least 70 years ago in a country that is run by a dictator. Mm-hmm. And we open, there's some opening captions that tell us as much. Tell us about this dictator. Tell us about the fact that people are being lined up and shot in the streets and all this stuff. But we open not on the dictator, but you know what it is?
Keep going.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you know what this is. But we open not on the dictator, but on a concert, on a classical concert that's happening in this. Yep, that's happening in this state. And this lovely pianist is playing an aria with a full orchestra. And the guys in the booth operating it, this is a concert that's being played live and, on for the radio. And the guys in the booth are listening to it. It's very lovely. It's very peaceful. And then all of a sudden they get a phone call in the booth. And they go to pick up the phone.
Radio Moscow, Director Andreev, what is it?
On the other end of the phone is, who is it, Alex?
17 minutes.
It's Joseph Stalin.
Yes,
it's
Joseph Stalin.
Of course I can bring back
the movie,
in 17
of course,
minutes.
Death of Stalin.
We should get a doctor.
Yeah. Yes, if only we hadn't put away all those highly competent doctors for treason.
You remember? Yes, I do. I do. And, they were plotting. They were plotting to poison him.
Yes, that's right. You collected the evidence.
Yes, I did. I did. And are you still testing me?
I want to finish this story because I think it's fascinating. This opening is amazing to me. So Joseph Stalin calls them, and he is, he's like, I love this fucking concert. I want to get a recording of it. They're like, you want a recording? And like, it goes back and forth. Like there's like a whole back and forth. That's a brilliant writing back and forth of them trying to understand each other. And the concert ends, but these guys haven't gotten a recording. And in possibly one of the best opening scenes to a movie, to set up everything without telling you anything, the guys in the booth are so terrified of the fact that they didn't get a concert recording for Joseph Stalin that they run out and force everybody
stay.
Okay, nobody leave, lock those doors. If you wouldn't mind just taking your seats again, please, that would be fantastic. Take your fucking seats. Don't worry, nobody's gonna get killed, I promise you.
Get back in your fucking seats. Everybody sit down. People have already left. The band has already left. They have to go and get an entirely different conductor because the conductor that they had is already gone. And they bring everybody back in their pajamas and redo this concert.
Deepest apologies. Radio Moscow requests your presence immediately, please. You're Moscow's finest and nearest conductor. So we must hurry.
And the pianist is being very she is very clearly against Stalin. It's I'm not going to do this for below this amount of money. So she haggles with them. And it's a whole thing. Just you're rushing to see these people. And here is the most fucked up part. That shit actually happened.
That was true.
This is what's brilliant about the death of Stalin.
Oh my god!
Everything that happens in this movie actually fucking happened. They actually. Had that entire thing, they were actually doing this concert. Stalin comes, they're like, I want a recording. They're like, oh, we don't have recordings. He's like, we better get me a recording. And they're like, everyone get back. And they had to the only thing that's different is that the guy that they had to run and go get, the new conductor, he was already nearby, was called, but they all brought them back in their pajamas and they replayed this thing. And the fact that in the movie they have the pianist sneak a letter to Stalin. That's the letter that causes him to have a stroke.
Right.
right? You know, because what ends up happening is, you know, as per the movie, the Stalin dies. He has a heart attack in his room, and we'll get to that later. Because that's another really wonderful thing. And it's all the people who are under him vying for power in this vacuum now that Stalin is dead. That's the plot of the film. So here is here's literally what happened. The letter that she sent did not cause him to have a stroke, but in real life, she did send a letter that was like, "You are a fucking bastard, and like, I hate you." But here's what did happen that they do depict in the movie. Stalin has a stroke in his study, right? So he's up all night partying with, like, literally with his cabinet, right? Khrushchev, mm-hmm. Beria, Melnikov, all these guys who are like his
boys.
Yeah, these guys who are like sycophants and like just SSD just so that they don't get killed.
Yeah.
Isn't Steve Buscemi
one of them?
Steve Buscemi, he plays Khrushchev. And that's another history. I'm going to hit you with all these historical things because it's amazing.
Oh, you did your research. Okay.
Oh, my God. When I first saw the movie, I did my research because I was like, this can't be true. Dude, 95% of this movie is accurate to life. That is what's so insane. Khrushchev, in the movie, they have Khrushchev do this thing where he would go home and he would, you know, again, he's trying not to get killed by Stalin, and he knows that the one thing that he has over Stalin is that he can make Stalin laugh. So he would, you know, in the movie, they have him do this thing that's ridiculous where he goes home and talks to his wife about the jokes that, like, Stalin, that he told Stalin that Stalin laughed at and didn't laugh at. That is true.
I made a joke about the farmers.
Does Stalin laugh?
Yeah. He made a joke about the Navy. No laugh.
No more Navy jokes.
He actually did that. He would go home and talk to his wife about, write this down. Stalin laughed at this one. He didn't like this one. He loved this one. He didn't like this one. And like, just so he could know what to say to Stalin.
Oh my God.
Here's what's even crazier. So the man has a heart attack, falls over, makes a big thud. In the movie, the guards outside are like, should we go check on him? And they're like, no, it's fucking Stalin. We're not going in. He'll kill us if we interrupt his time. Again, actually freaking happened.
Actually happened.
These guards heard him. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a similar thing I read about, and I don't know who it was, but there was a queen in the 1700s or 1800s, and it was against the law to touch her.
Dude.
Right? You could be put to death if you touched the queen, and she fell off a boat and was drowning, and no people could have saved, like, there were all these people around, and nobody wanted to jump in and save her because it meant death. To touch her.
Death. And that's the kind of fear that this guy had over these people. They literally let him die because they thought they were like freaking out. And like,
so funny.
It's so like the amount of detail in this movie and things that they didn't have to make up is kind of insane. You know, there's just,
I saw it, but it was a long time ago. Does it all take place in the course of like 24, 48 hours? Like it's a pretty,
maybe. Yeah. It came out 2018. I think it's like maybe they might condense a lot of time, but it does take place in
it's all like the immediate days. Reaction to Stalin dying and what do we do
the
about it,
like the week after he's died, but again, like everything, like even down to, you know, this you know, if you know history, then you know the ending of this movie, which is that so Beria, who's played by the amazing Simon Russell Beale, if you watch the original Penny Dreadful, he is in that, and he is just an incredible British actor and stage and screen actor, just huge talent, plays Beria, who, you know, the movie is really framed as really a kind of a, you know, a grudge match between Beria and Khrushchev, mm-hmm. played by Steve Buscemi, and who's gonna take over first. And like, you know, like there's this one scene where the daughter that, you know, the kind of the prize to be won, the heart who you have to win, is the daughter. So they all like hear the daughter pulling up in their cars, and they're all like out in the woods plotting. They all run to meet her, because like she has to like get in touch with her. And here's an even crazier thing. Stalin has this son who, oh my God, what's his name? I think it's like Nikolai or like some, you know, some weird, you know, not weird. That's just some Russian name. And, Stalin at the time in the movie, at the time that Stalin dies, his son is worried because he's like, his son is like a black sheep, fuck up, like drunk, and sends like, is like trying to build like a Russian hockey team, and like sends them in like a plane that is like he, somebody told him like, hey, don't send them in this plane because it's like problematic, and the entire Russian hockey team dies. So he tries to like get a new hockey team so his dad doesn't know that he killed the old hockey team. Actually happened. He killed the Russian hockey team and he's like scrambling to get a new one. But like, you know, one of the most fucked up things that happened is just like, you're again in full concordance with what we're talking about, which is like, these are the people who have their hand on the button. Even the way that they like, you know, that Khrushchev finally gets over Beria, like it's this like sloppy, half slapstick, half terrifying coup. Right. Because, yeah, you know, that final scene where they get, you know, he gets like the military boss, played by Jason Isaacs, teams up with him, and then they like overthrow him in a meeting. And it's like this horrible thing where like, you know, it's just so haphazardly put together. But one of the things that I think is, it was the moment that I solidified the movie for me. The movie has been, up until this point, there's not one bit of this movie that feels, it's dark humor, but it's like hysterical. And then when they capture Beria, who's like a horrible person, by the way, like he, you know, and truthful, you know, historically as well, is like, you know, he is creating death lists where he just sends soldiers out to kill people willy-nilly, no matter, you know, just because they said something wrong to him or whatever, and like holds women prisoners and rapes them, like rapes children. Like he was a true sociopath. And yet when he gets overthrown, they, like the way that he, you know, they beat him up, and they have like a makeshift tribunal for him, and they shoot him dead in like literally in like this truly like very suddenly stark and like dark thing. Yeah. Like it, all of a sudden the movie stops being funny and you're just watching this man like scream at his fellow council members.
Because it's real.
Because it's real. It's all real. Yeah, and like, and the only difference is that there was a bit of time in the movie, the coup takes place the same day that his execution was. And in real life, there was a little bit of time between his execution and the coup, but like still dragged him out and shot him. And it's really effective, man. And it goes back to, you know, I think this is why I say there's only two people who have done this so well. Armando Iannucci, who is the director of this movie, the writer of this movie, also known for Veep, also known for In the Loop, also known for a bunch of these kind of farces of politics. I think he's just the best. He's the best that we have at this genre. I mean, if you look at all of his work, it is truly, he gets these actors who just have these, like, who just know how to be, you know how to just throw wit around. Julia Louis-Dreyfus in Veep is a revelation. Like, if you haven't watched her work in that TV show, I only
watched the first season of it, but I've heard great things.
This is literally Veep in movie form, set in Russia in the 1950s. It's so good, and I can't say enough good things about it. I love this movie so much.
Yeah, I remember loving it. I don't remember, you know, beat for beat, but I remember the tone. The fact that it all actually happened is pretty crazy to me. And as I'm reading about it, as you're talking too, it's been the real world effect, right? That it was on Obama's best of 2018 list. At the same time, it's been banned in Russia.
Yeah.
Seen as an unfriendly act by the British intellectual class. Because I was thinking, like, okay, it's a movie about Russians with UK and American actors, and then written, you know, produced by people with names that are neither British nor American. And it looks like it's UK, France, and Belgium are the three countries that kind of made it together.
What I love about it too is because of how specific they made it, you watch the movie, and especially I remember watching the movie, I was still on tour with Hamilton. It was actually my first tour city. I saw it in Seattle. And it was when I was, you know, when I was out on an injury, I just met up with my buddy JP, and we just went and saw this movie. And like, you know, then at that point we were 2 years into the Trump administration, and you just watch the movie and you're like, that's it. That's Trump.
That's it. That's what's actually happening.
Actually happening.
And a much better version of farce, I think, than Dave.
I just think that he understands it. And like Dave is farce, but Dave, I think, from what I remember of Dave, it's very much character driven in terms of like you're rooting for Dave, and I think that's so important.
It is. Yeah, it's feel good and not uncomfortable. It feels uncomfortable when you realize the implications of what what the story is. But this, I mean, Death of Stalin is really something where it's like, oh God, the people at the wheel are drunk
idiots. They're
like
idiots.
This is all of certain, and it's hard not to look at Stalin and the Soviet Union in relationship to, you know, Hitler and Nazi Germany all these other, you know, dictatorships through time, where you realize like so much of it is theatrics, so much of it is a small group of people convincing a large group of people of something, and then being something different, like the power of messaging. And that's what was scary about Trump. And I would love that we can talk about this as a was.
As
and
a was.
Is. Oh my God, it feels so good. That's what was the threat with Trump, is a small group of people who are very obviously looking out for themselves and without the mental faculty to make rational decisions in the best interest of the people. Convincing large swaths of people, most of them, you know, uneducated, maybe, unwilling to open their minds.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
However you want to phrase it, it's a serious threat, and it's been repeated over and over and over through history. You know, the whole doom to repeat itself thing, it really came back out with Trump. So I'm glad that we've been able to kind of skirt the disaster.
Yeah. And for now, because I think this is the other thing you have to consider. And that's why I love your definition of political theater, is it's theater. The problem with political theater is that you can't argue with it, because it's not, the very nature of it is not founded in any fact. It is literally make-believe. Right. That is what political...
I mean, theater is a lie. Theater and film, right? That's what they teach you right at the beginning, that it's a lie. Guy, what's his name? Film is 24 lies a second or something like...
Oh, yeah.
Something pretentious like that.
But like, it's
true.
It's every Christopher Nolan film, like, you know, which is a meta-commentary on film itself. It's like film... storytelling isn't, you're creating illusions, and that's what,
to evoke emotional reaction, right? So when that hits the real game, you know, I wouldn't want to run a country based
on emotional reactions, which is why I think you know looking at, again, I just say looking at Biden, and even looking, you know, there, people are so afraid of the quote unquote progressives who are going to push him further left, but here's the thing. If you look at the two progressives who everyone on the right is most afraid of, AOC and Bernie Sanders, these are two people who, you know, I arguably, you know, Bernie Sanders has obviously been there since the dawn of freaking time, but AOC doesn't come without the Occupy Wall Street movement, right? AOC doesn't come without a bunch of these movements that happened that weren't about theater. We're just about people being like, please look at this. This is a problem. Look at this. So I think what I always sense about AOC, people's problem with AOC and Bernie Sanders and even Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, is like, they're really, you know, Kamala Harris, I actually would have a conversation about with in terms of this, but like, people are really just telling the truth. That's what I like about, like, say what you want about Joe Biden's record, say what you want about whatever, like, but like, the man makes a point to tell the truth. I loved in his last, I think it was either his town hall or his last debate, he got asked a question that he didn't know the answer to, so he pulled out a freaking cue card and he looked up the stats. And it was like, I prefer that.
That's what we need.
Just be boring. Just look up the stats. Like, just be real.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, man.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happened too is the elasticity of the political spectrum has gotten to the point where the right has, with all their tricks and smoke and mirrors and everything, has pulled everything so far right, has pulled the right so far right in their thinking, that now when they say, look at the left, and that's pulled the left right, right? Because the left's trying to meet them in the middle, but they've been moving the goalpost in the middle. The goalpost has been shifting right. So when they look at the radical left, really, Bernie and AOC in any other modern democratic society are just normal left.
Yes.
It's just normal. Hey, it's just healthcare And everybody needs to chip it. You know, people who are making $1 billion need to chip in a little more. That's the messaging. And that makes sense in any normal society. That's the problem with this theater. That's the problem with convincing these people what it is, because they're saying like, that's evil, that somehow that they're radical and they want to destroy you, and it's communism and it's social. It's like, it's absurdity when you think about it. But they've convinced enough people at this point now that there's no going back. There's no convincing them otherwise. So it's like, how do you adjust the messaging? How do you pull back the other way and get people to kind of see how off center everything is?
Yeah. 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 And hopefully, you know, and again, looking at like Stacey Abrams, looking at, you know, the fight for Georgia that we got coming up in a month, you know, or 2 months.
Alaska just went, I think all we can hope for now is to have equal.
Yeah.
Split in the Senate, something like that, which is going to cause its own problems, even if Georgia pulls through. But
yeah,
we'll fight.
Yeah, we'll fight. And just a return to rational debate.
Rational. Just good old partisan obstructionism.
That's
how it should be.
How it should be. Just obstruction. But yeah, so the political farce, Dave and the Death of Stalin. Two great films. Check them out if you haven't. Get at us both, with anyone.
And watch Doctor Strange. If you've never seen Doctor Strangelove, you kind of need to know
what
it is.
Check it out.
You need to watch it. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And at some point, we'll do other political stuff. I want to get into like...
Oh, yeah. Let's do political
like,
stuff.
Political, like military political, like Tom Clancy stuff, Manchurian Candidate, stuff like that. You know, that's the real shit right there.
That's the real shit. All right. Well, listen, everybody, take care of yourselves. Stay safe. And we'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.